Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
In 2005, director Andrew Adamson and star Georgie Henley gave the world an earnest interpretation of one of the world's most beloved children's books.
In 2024, we go cheap and we go Irish.
The film is The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, The Witch, and The Wardrobe.
The whiskey is Clontarf Classic Blend, or as I like to call it, The Chronicles of Tarfia.
We will be reviewing both of those chronicles, Bob. This is
the Film and Whiskey Podcast.
Welcome to the Film and Whiskey Podcast, where each week we review a classic movie and a glass of whiskey. I'm Bob Book.
I'm Brad G.
And today we are looking at the third highest grossing film of 2005, The Chronicles of Narnia, : The Lion, The Witch, and The Wardrobe. Now, Brad, I've already said something that I feel like I need to correct. I said this was the third highest grossing film of the year. It was on a worldwide scale. On a domestic scale, it was the fourth highest grossing film of the year. And once again, we find ourselves in the middle of this season where we are reviewing high-grossing films with a fork in the road. We have reviewed the top two grossing films of this year, which were Star Wars Episode III and what was the other one?
Who cares? Because Star Wars Episode III, what a movie, man.
Oh, Goblet of Fire. Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire.
Oh, yeah.
And three and four were either Steven Spielberg's War of the Worlds or The Chronicles of Narnia.
Which now, I want to watch War of the Worlds at some point.
It is a fantastic movie until like the last 5 minutes. And even then, it's still a really good movie. I have a sneaking suspicion we'll probably watch it someday. We just like Spielberg. So I'm assuming that we're going to continue watching Spielberg stuff the farther we get into this podcast. You know,
speaking of Tom Cruise.
We hadn't spoken of Tom Cruise, but go ahead.
Literally yesterday, Bob, I was running an event for my work, and we had a participant from Singapore, and she told me that I looked like Tom Cruise.
Wow.
And I said, I am that short. Thank you so much for the compliment.
Mm. I'm not going to crash that dream for you.
It made my day, man.
Yeah, I bet it did. I'm not going to say anything else. You know what, Brad? You do look like Tom Cruise.
That's right, I do.
All right, let's get into talking about The Chronicles of Narnia. Folks, if this is your first time listening to our podcast, we want to say hello, welcome in. This is the Film and Whiskey Podcast. We watch movies, we drink whiskey. This year, we are looking at the highest grossing films of each year from 1988 to 2019. Brad, as I've been saying the last few weeks, we are in the sort of calm before the storm, where even though we're starting to get into IPville here and Disneyville, it still seems like these are real movies. You know what I mean? Like, this seemed like a big deal of a movie when it came out, at least for Disney.
Oh, Chronicles was huge when it came out. I remember it like really doing it. It really made big waves, partially like in the Christian world, because it's a Christian IP that was taken seriously, but also in the general populace, it seemed like people really liked this movie.
Yeah, especially people of a certain age. This was, I think it did have the specter of Disney hanging over it. And it was, I think when people looked at it less generously, it was always looked at as kind of, this is Disney's knockoff of Lord of the Rings. And it is mm-hmm. both not as good as Lord of the Rings and also has to be PG. And so it can't be as good as Lord of the Rings. Yeah. And I think that was always kind of hindering it a little bit. But at the end of the day, this is an adaptation of a children's book. And you can argue that Lord of the Rings is. I wouldn't say that about Lord of the Rings, but
no, this the, is the this Hobbit is, yes. is a adaptation of a children's
exactly. book. Exactly. And I will say, I think this is better than the adaptations of The Hobbit in a number of ways.
You're dead on right it is, Bob. You don't have Benedict Cumberbatch saying, "I am death" at the end of the film, which is
so
the
good.
Only.
That's the best part of the whole trilogy.
Not just the best, the only good part of those trilogies.
All right, so as we start looking at Narnia, Brad, what is your association with this IP? Like, did you grow up reading the books? Did you grow up watching the movies? Where are we on Narnia as a podcast?
Yeah, I love Narnia. I grew up reading the books. I remember, you know how you have like early memories where you're like, I don't remember anything else that was happening, but I have a vague memory of being like 7 and watching the old, I believe, BBC like television movies.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
So I do recall watching Eustace turn into a dragon and back on the BBC TV show. That's emblazoned upon my memory. So I have been very closely affiliated with Lewis's works here for a long, long time. And I remember when this came out being very excited.
Yeah, and I'm in the opposite camp. I mean, I didn't grow up Christian and I didn't grow up reading fantasy. So like that kind of took me out of the running for being a Narnia fan. And so, you know, after I became a Christian later in life and went to college and studied theology, C.S. Lewis's books, non-Narnia books, were always recommended to me. And I love Lewis. Mere Christianity is one of my favorite books of all time.
Dude, The Great Divorce.
Dude, I love The Great Divorce so much. It's so good. That's my let's make it a double. Read The Great Divorce and then watch this movie.
Yes. Yes.
But dude. I will say, like, It came with that sort of like evangelical snootiness that people would be like, you never read Narnia? You never watched Narnia? No,
which
I didn't.
Which is super funny because like Lewis is so Catholic.
And also, but Lewis has a great quote about chronological snobbery. And I think that goes over a lot mm-hmm. of Christians' heads. Anyway,
yeah.
So at some point I was just like, I'm not going to read Narnia. It was more of like a stamp my foot and cross my arms. Like, I don't need Narnia.
I'm
going
to read Harry Potter. Well, I don't need Narnia.
I was already past the target age and I was reading Lewis's stuff for adults and loving it. And people were like, well, you don't know about Aslan. I'm like, who the hell cares? You know what I mean? Like, mind your business. So my association with Narnia was way different. And I think, honestly, this movie was probably my first exposure to the world of Narnia at all. And so it's a really interesting place to start because being familiar with the books now, it is both a pretty faithful adaptation of the book and also kind of a lackluster adaptation of the book in a lot of ways. And I'm excited to dive into talking to you about it, Brad, because Lord of the Rings, this is not. But I do think that it is a pretty good movie on its own merits and not just a pretty good Lord of the Rings knockoff.
Yeah, 100%. As I was watching this film, you feel the Lord of the Rings influence, like pushing this movie forward.
Mm-hmm.
And yet this movie remains too silly to ever like dive into the depths that Lord of the Rings has created.
For sure.
And the beautiful thing is it should be silly. Like you're following a group of 4 children who become knights in a matter of a day.
Yep.
And they're all of a sudden they're kingly because Aslan says that they're kingly. Like there's so much more going on here than just what you see on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it is what it is.
Right.
And I think when you look at what it's trying to do, I think it does a relatively good job.
Yeah, I'm kind of in that place too. And it is okay to watch a movie that is pretty good. And honestly, Brad, it's kind of freeing for this podcast because when we watch movies that have reputations of being great, then it's like, oh my gosh, we have the weight of critical consensus mm-hmm. on our side here or working against us. And now it's like, we're just watching a movie that's pretty good. It's got a 6.9 on IMDb. And we get to talk about...
I think it's a little low.
A little low, but like not terribly low.
I was surprised to see it under 7. Yeah. I would have thought it was like a 7.2, 7.3.
All right, man. Let's get into our first segment of the day, which we call Brad Explains.
Brad's going to give us the movie plot with only 60 seconds ticking on the clock. So let's go ahead and hear your take with this little segment that we call Brad Explains.
Brad Explains is the part of the podcast where Brad breaks down the plot of the movie that he has just seen, often for the first time. I have not asked you this yet, Brad. How many times have you seen this movie?
This is probably in, you know, one of my highest watched films, about 3-4 times.
This is time number 2 for me. I saw this in the theater in 2005. I have not seen it since. So it was kind of cool to revisit because I remember like vague things about it. I remember certain images, or I thought I did. And it was really nice to revisit it after almost 2 decades and get a better picture of what the movie actually is versus what I've made it out to be, which is just that, a knockoff of Lord of the Rings.
Honestly, that's kind of how I felt last week with Passion, where I'm like, yeah, I like vaguely remember watching that. Like, I think twice, like right when it came out, and then I hadn't seen it in 20 years and was like, yeah, I kind of remember some, you know, weird old baby stuff, but I don't know. I cried a lot.
Can I tell you a quick story about the Passion of the Christ? So in my town growing up, there was the multiplex movie theater, and then there was a theater across town that only had one screen. It was like a big old movie theater, and they would get second run movies. And I had seen The Passion with a church group when it first came out at the multiplex, and then like 3 months later it was playing at the other theater. And one of my friends had said, like, I really want to see The Passion, but I haven't had a chance. And so we went to see The Passion of the Christ together in this big empty movie theater where like the only other person in the movie theater sat in the row right behind us. And we're like 14 years old. And of course, like, we're teenagers, so we're hungry all the time. So we get a big bucket of popcorn to watch the crucifixion of Christ. And like mid crucifixion, the bucket of popcorn falls off my lap and lands on like all the way upside down on the floor. And when we try to pick it up, all the popcorn spills out. And so now we're giggling and we're trying to kick the popcorn like under the chairs in front of us to hide the evidence. It was perhaps the most sacrilegious thing I've ever done, Brad. It was an accident, but my memory of the Passion is like, this is what you're doing while the crucifixion is happening.
Dude, I can just see it now. I am making all things new, Mother.
Popcorn everywhere.
Yep. Everywhere.
All right. On that note, Brad, you have 60 seconds to break down the plot of this movie, The Chronicles of Narnia, and go.
During World War II. Oh, wait, Bob.
You didn't get your patented intro in there. Yeah.
The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is a film about the 4 Pevensey children who are shipped off in the middle of World War II to the country of side of England. They live in a house owned by an old eccentric professor. In the midst of exploring the house, they find themselves lost in a magical wardrobe, whereupon they stumble into a land, an entire country called Narnia. Mm. Once they're in Narnia, Lucy goes first and comes back and tries to convince her brothers and sisters about it. Edmund goes at some point, is enchanted by the White Witch, who tells him to bring his siblings back to her. Eventually, they all make it in. The White Witch captures Edmund. The other 3 siblings go on an adventure to find Aslan, who will help them save Edmund. Once they are there, they save Edmund, but Aslan has to sacrifice his life for Edmund's betrayal, upon which Aslan has a deeper magic, is resurrected, definitely not like last week's movie, and he saves the day, killing the White Witch. Mm. And dude, when Aslan says, "It is finished," ooh. Mm. Oh, come on, man. Eh. Get out. Bob, you can go kick rocks.
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. There's really good moments in this movie. That one didn't quite land for me.
Oh, man.
Here's the thing is like in the book, there's certain things that I think are not unadaptable, but certainly lost in translation when you adapt from one medium to the next. Sure. And one of the famous lines from the book is right at the end of the movie here as well, where they say Aslan is not a tame lion, but he's a good one. And like, when you read that in the context of the theology of the book, and this is a very obvious naked metaphor for the death and resurrection of Christ. And when when you read that in the book, it's like, ooh, that hits really hard. In the context of the movie, it's just dialogue between Tumnus and Lucy. And it just kind of doesn't, like, it's just two lines that are split between two characters. And you almost don't really hear it. It doesn't land with the same impact. And in the book, yes, Aslan doing those things and saying it is finished, like, absolutely. Yeah, because it's right there and I get it because I'm seeing the words. It just doesn't quite work as well for me in the context of this movie. And
sure,
you know, it's not that it doesn't work at all. It's just that you're kind of like the Leonardo DiCaprio pointing at the screen meme. You're like, I see it. I see what you did there, Jesus.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you on the Aslan's not a safe lion, but he's good. Mm-hmm. Like that just didn't feel, it just felt like weird, partially because they never set up.
Yes.
That he's like not safe. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It feels like that line would have been better if it was, and I think in the book it's when Beaver is describing Aslan to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that would make a lot more sense than like as he's leaving the scene, like, oh yeah, he's not safe, but he's good. It's like, well, we already knew that he was good.
And also that he's not tame. We just saw him eat a woman's face like 3 minutes ago. What are you talking about?
Yeah. Poor Tilda Swinton, man.
Yeah. You know what? Fun fact, this is apocryphal to the books, but after Aslan ate her face, he wandered off and became the main lion in the Siegfried and Roy show.
Oh, yeah, wow. Yeah. That's really cool.
Yep.
I didn't know that.
Just eating faces left and right. So, Brad. Oh, you mentioned something about how they don't really set up things in the movie. And that's one of my main points that I'd like to hear from you about. I say all the time, like, we don't need all this backstory, like, just get us into the movie. And I'm kind of like eating my words a little bit with this movie because
this whole season, man, I feel like there's been a few movies where you're like, I want 10 more minutes of Qui-Gon. Give me more backstory, baby.
I know. And this movie in particular, it's like, I think it's a half hour too long, but I think that it also, it needs to lose that half hour and then give like 4 minutes back into just giving me some sort of context for like, where are these children living? Who is this guy? What's the relationship? Is he an uncle? Like, did I miss a line of dialogue? And then all of a sudden, like, they find this wardrobe, they're in Narnia, they come back and they talk to the professor and he's like, yeah, I don't know. Like, maybe that does happen. And it's like, wait, what? Like, are you aware of the, what's going on here?
Not just any professor, Professor Horace Slughorn from Hogwarts.
Of course. Jim Broadbent.
Mm. What a great, great character.
My point being, I don't feel like they really established, and again, like, he is not Narnia, so they want to get to the Narnia parts. I get that. But, like, who is this man? From whence did this wardrobe come? How does he know about its magical powers? Like, just a little bit of world building would have been really helpful there.
I can't disagree with you more. I think that the opening, like, 30 minutes of this movie are literally perfect.
Mm.
Like, the opening bombing scene is great. It establishes the characters and what they want and who they are and the rift that is growing between the children. And, like, them getting sent off to the country to somebody that they don't really know works perfectly because the film is given from the viewpoint of the children. And so the children are being sent off to this weird, eccentric uncle person that their mother knows that they don't know anything about. And you discover things about the professor as they do. And I think that part of it was perfect. You don't need the explanation. You just need to see it from the kid's point of view so that you get that feeling of like uncertainty and I don't know what's going on and I'm away from home and I don't know who this person is and this housekeeper is kind of a bee and we're running away from her. And I think that if there's anything of this movie that needed to be explained more, it's a lot of the stuff in Narnia that, like, when you started talking, I thought you were going to say, like, yeah, there's so much stuff happening in Narnia that I wish I had more context for. And I would have said, yes, I'm with you 100%. But the opening part of the movie, man, I'm all in on that. That for me was like a 9 out of 10. I thought they were hitting on all cylinders.
Mm. Cool. Okay, so moving on. I just, and again, like it's a nitpick for me, but it's also the part of the movie that matters the least. So it's like, I'm not going to argue with you on that. Okay, let's dive into the performances here a little bit. And this is an interesting movie to talk about performances because usually the child actors are the performances that we try to talk about either the least or the last. Because it's like, you don't want to criticize kid performances. But this movie,
but boy, are we getting ready to.
This movie is centered on four different child actor performances.
Have you ever seen a movie with like four lead child actors?
No. I mean, like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, or like, you know, the old Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. But that's anchored by Grandpa Joe and Gene Wilder. Like,
yeah,
the stars of this movie are four children.
The youngest of which is like the most on screen.
Yes. And they're all pretty good for children. Like, you do have to grade them on the scale of children actors. But on the scale of children actors, they're all like an 8 out of 10, I would say.
Yeah, that was the main thing I wanted to take note of. I think that if I had to rank them in terms of like who I think is best, I would probably go Lucy. Edmund and Susan are kind of both interchangeable in the middle for me. Mm. And I think that the oldest boy, Peter, I don't have the actor's name pulled up.
William Moseley.
William Moseley. I think he's the least. There's moments where I'm like, oh, he's a solid 8.5 out of 10 B actor. But there's also a few where I'm like, you don't really have any emotion going on in your face. What's going on, dude?
Yeah, and there's also a few moments where they ask the kids to have an outpouring of emotion, and you can kind of see them straining for, my body needs to produce tears right now. So, like,
yeah,
and that those kind of moments really do take a viewer out of the actual movie. At least they did for me. And, you know, like when Aslan dies, spoiler alert, when Aslan dies and we get them kind of weeping on his body. It's effective, but it could have been more effective. And I think that's kind of my whole, if I could sum up my entire take on this movie, it's like, it is effective. I am going to give this movie a good score, but I was left wondering through most of the film, like, how much more effective could this have been if only X? Like, there was always something in almost every scene, whether it was, man, if this was just a little bit, if the set didn't look so fake here, or if the CGI was a little better, or if this didn't have like a C-minus director, like something could have made this movie better.
Bob's coming.
Oh, I'm
hard
sorry.
Andrew Adamson.
I was going to say, do we have a big Andrew Adamson fan in the house today?
Just a huge Adamson stan over here. Do we know any other movies he's directed?
Well, let's see. He directed, no, he did Prince Caspian after this. Oh, he directed Shrek 2 and Shrek 1. He directed Shrek 1, dude.
There you go. See? This is world famous Andrew Adamson.
Mm, my guy.
He's so forgettable that I literally wrote his name into my intro like 3 weeks ago for Shrek. And I didn't even remember it.
Nope. All right. So, I mean, seriously, though, my take being, this is pretty good. It could be a lot better. Is that a fair take on the movie overall?
I think it is. And I think that the reason it falls away from being great is because there's so much to put into this movie. And it's wild because the actual book of, you know, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe isn't a long book. Like, you're not dealing with the Fellowship of the Ring. And yet I felt like they kind of rushed through so much of the Narnia stuff that I was always left wanting to know more about Narnia.
Mm.
I think that everything through Edmund's visit to Narnia everything after that just feels rushed and like, okay, I guess there's Santa now. And I guess,
freaking
you know,
Santa. Discount Dumbledore wanders into this movie. It's like, ho, 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 kids. Here's a sword. Go fight a witch.
Oh, that was one of the things that pissed Tolkien off about Lewis's books. He was like, listen, man, you can't write fantasy and just put Christmas,
right,
like Santa Claus, in your fantasy novel. That's like, not okay.
Tell and me Lewis about Christmas, like, in Narnia. Are they aware of the birth of Jesus Christ? Like, what is going on?
Dang, I better well believe that they are. Oh, man. It's stuff like that that, as an adult, I'm like, I'm kind of with Tolkien on this.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're a kid reading, like, Chronicles of Narnia, it's this moment of like, oh, they celebrate Christmas too. And, like, you know, it feels like a cheap way of garnering audience, you know, approval. But when your audience is like 4 to 9 year olds, who cares, man? Everybody likes Christmas.
So last week we reviewed, I guess 2 weeks ago, we reviewed Pirates of the Caribbean. And you talked about how incredibly violent that movie was. And I got to be honest, man, I remember seeing this movie in the theater and being kind of like, psh, this is trying really hard to do the Battle of Pelennor Fields from the third Lord of the Rings. And this is a poor imitation of that. And I will eat my words from 15-year-old Bob today, because especially the first half of the battle, there is some really inventive camera work when you're following the eagle, bird, whatever they are, as they're dropping the rocks on people.
The griffin, Bob?
Sure, whatever. They the rocks hit those guys with such impact, and it's like, oh
yeah.
This is so. First point is, Andrew Adamson, I will give you credit. You designed a really, really good half of a battle before they cut away to Aslan, because I think the second half of the battle is kind of poopy. But
yeah.
But secondly, what a violent film this is to secure a PG rating. Many people getting slashed to death, getting faces eaten, getting crushed by rocks.
No blood though.
No blood.
It's totally okay.
Yeah. Do you think that there was blood when Aslan ate her face?
Oh, no. She's a witch. She just kind of poofed into smoke.
Yeah, and they cut back to Aslan, and there's no blood on him. No.
Can you imagine if there was?
just like her face, the entire just flap of her face just hanging from a tooth.
It's like in Return of the Jedi, like, he's like throwing her arm up in the air and like gobbling it down like he's the Rancor.
Yes. Just burps some of her dreadlocks out.
Oh, man, that would be incredible. Bob, I'm with you 100% on this battle. I think especially the first half is killer. I like the second half. I think the fight between Peter and the White Witch is pretty well done. Not great. For me, there's something about seeing like a traditional knight that I realized, I was like, I don't know if I've ever seen in a movie a truly traditional knight who's like the main character fighting with like old school, like chainmail and plate armor and a shield and a sword. And there was something about that that I really enjoyed that at the end of the fight scene. But dude, the opening part of the fight scene, I also don't know if I've ever seen such a cool geography laid out. Like, they're fighting in this like hilly, like almost like a Scottish Highland crags, and you see the armies like pouring through it like water. And I'm like, yeah, most fight scenes that you ever see, you know, Battle of Pelennor Fields, you know, all these famous things, they're either set around like a fortification, like Helm's Deep, or they're just in a giant, open, empty space.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the choice of geography was incredible for the final battle.
I agree. And one of the things that has really bothered me about this movie upon this rewatch, it had a $180 million budget. It was a huge budget for a movie like this. And it's really clear that they put a lot of that money into the CGI, and they put a lot of the money into the special effects in the battle scene. And I think that especially in the first part of that battle scene, you get these huge sprawling kind of vistas. There's a lot of aerial shots where the camera is literally moving overhead. It's really well done. And you can see how much effort they put into the coverage and the filming of that sequence. What really bothers me, though, is like there are times in this movie where they'll just the kids will just be like, I was right after they came out of the waterfall. And you could tell that everything was green screened. And it was like, wow, this must have been reshoots or something, because like there's some really bad green screening going on.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other times where it just seems like, oh, this is like this isn't even outside. This is on a set in a soundstage somewhere that you just covered in fake snow. And there are moments where the sets just look really chintzy in this movie. And it kind of pulls me out of the movie. And I don't know if it's just the way they lit them, the way they filmed them, the lensing. Like, I don't know enough about the movie making magic that did not go into parts of this movie. But like, you know, I have to imagine Lord of the Rings was the same. Everything there was built on sound stages. And yet the way that they shoot those scenes, I think about like Rivendell. And it's oh my gosh, like this is, there's so much detail here in Minas Tirith and the kind of grime that lives on the white stone of Minas Tirith. It's like everything feels lived in, everything feels real, but it still feels massive and regal. And Narnia kind of feels like it exists in like a 3-square-mile radius. And they're like, yeah, we got to get over that hill there. And that's like the end of Narnia. And so like you never feel like you're in this great big world. And I think it's because of the limitations of the filmmaking. And that's what really sucked is I wanted this to be a world I was curious about, but it felt like it was like a small village that I was getting curious about.
I think for me, the reason that that all kind of comes about is with Lord of the Rings, you have this deep sense of adult adventure, like end of the world type of stuff. I think with Chronicles of Narnia, because the main characters are four children, like as the viewer, you just feel like the stakes are lower. Like, I don't know how else to describe it other than to say everything in the world feels a little more like a fairy tale than a fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like Lord of the Rings is a fantasy adventure, even though Tolkien like meant it as a fairy tale. And Lewis's feels like a fairy tale. Like it feels like a place that Tinkerbell would live in.
Yes.
So much more so than like the grounded, gritty, real world built in Lord of the Rings.
Well, and I think part of that is like Lord of the Rings has a very focused narrative of like this and then this, but this, so this, and like everything that we've ever talked about with how to construct a compelling narrative. Whereas I think fairy tale is the perfect phrase for this, Brad, because like other fairy tales, even like Grimm Brothers fairy tales, it's not so much about what happens in the fairy tale as it is about the moral that they're trying to teach. And the moral here is the gospel. So the actual motivations for the characters sometimes feel a little muddy or non-existent. And they're told that there's a prophecy and that they're going to be kings and queens. So let's go do this stuff. And then their brother gets kidnapped and they're like, OK, well, now we have to rescue our brother. But it still feels like there are thinner character motivations here than there are throughout the Lord of the Rings. And it's because this is a fairy tale and Lord of the Rings is not. I think you really hit the nail on the head here.
Yeah. And that is a key thing that I feel like is underdeveloped is the, well, this is a prophecy. And so, you know, this is what's happening. Dude, all you have to do is have a recall. So, like, they're in Beaver's hut talking to Mr. and Mrs. Beaver, and they're explaining the prophecy. And have you seen the clip of the Great British Baking Show where the woman brings up a cake that is a cartoon beaver?
Oh, yeah.
And the lady goes, let's talk about your beaver.
Listen, I watched this whole movie without chuckling, but when you said they're in Beaver's hut, it's like, what a euphemism. I'm sorry. Please finish your point while I continue being juvenile.
I'm trying to set the stage here, Bob. All you have to do is have Mr. Beaver tell the four children like the prophecy, like line by line, like a poem. Read the prophecy. It's like, you know, 6 lines long. Doesn't take that long. And have the music that Mr. Tumnus plays on his little flute to put Lucy to sleep, have that playing like really softly in the background,
And boom, you have an epic scene with an epic prophecy. And now all of the children, right? Because the movie is filmed from the children's perspective, now we, the audience, and the children have received the prophecy, and it's been placed upon us, and we feel the mysticism, and there's cool music playing in the background. And I'm like, oh, that's all you had to do. And now you have the prophecy, and you have your motivation. But instead, it's just, there's a prophecy. Go, go, go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a prophecy that, like, you didn't even buy into. There's just a prophecy that people are going to come, and then they are kings. And you seem like those people, so go ahead.
They're going to come, and then they're kings.
Listen, dude, so one of the reviews that I read for this movie was from The New Yorker, and I almost sent you the passage. It was one of the funniest movie reviews I've ever read. And the critic was talking about how the story of Narnia has for decades stirred the souls of the faithful, but then he says it has also stirred the loins of professional Freudians. And he laid out like the what the Freudian reading of this movie is.
Uh-huh.
First Lucy, then Edmund, then all four children feel their way uncertainly through the folds of a deep furry passage and into another world. And boy, oh boy, if that isn't the place where we need to break for whiskey, Brad.
Yeah, Lewis the pedophile. that's definitely the take we wanted to come away with here on the Film and Whiskey podcast.
Let's drink some Clontarf. What do you say?
I'm ready, man. Let's get to it.
With Kizik hands-free shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy-on, easy-off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
All right, so today we are checking out Clontarf 1014 Classic Blend Irish Whiskey. Brad, this is a cheap Irish whiskey, one that I've heard is good as a mixer, and I picked it up on the OHLQ Ohio Liquor Last Call shelf because they stopped carrying this size of it or this bottle or something. It cost me like $11. And I said, boy, oh boy, is that a Film and Whiskey selection right there.
Heck yeah, dude.
So this is made by Pernod Ricard. They have a subsidiary called Irish Distillers, and they are the ones who create this brand. It's not attached to any particular distillery because it is a blended Irish whiskey. Apparently, in Ireland, there are other things that are released under the Clontarf brand, like a single malt. But in the States, we only get this. And so I am very excited to dive into this, Brad. It's been a while since we've had a cheapo whiskey, and it's been a minute since we've had an Irish whiskey. So, like, we're just crossing things off the list here.
Well, and this is perfect to pair with, as the author of the famed Chronicles of Narnia is Irish.
Hmm. And probably a fan of cheap whiskey.
I don't know, man. I could see Lewis and Tolkien putting down some really expensive scotch.
But also having debates with just a giant glass of Clontarf in hand.
Oh, yeah, dude. 100%.
All right, man, let's dive in. I'm drinking this live. You are drinking it in the past, apparently. I think you have notes to bring here. So,
yeah, hold on. Let me get in my time machine and go back to when I was drinking it.
Brad, what are you picking up on the nose of Clontarf?
This is a relatively pleasant nose. I think that it's got some floral notes. It has some like really nice light milk chocolatey things going on. There's some honeysuckle. It's overall a really pleasant, light, unoffensive nose. If I had to give a negative note, it feels young.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you'd expect here. I think it's decent. I'll give it a 6.5, Bob.
Brad, I really like this nose for what it is. It is very light, very airy. If you look at the color of it in the glass, it is not a very dark whiskey. But it has what I love on a lot of these Irish whiskeys that scotches sometimes don't have, which is a sort of almost like a floral, heathery kind of note to it. It's like really deep honey and some floral as well. And I really like that. You can tell that it's going to be a little bit harsh on the palate, or it's at least hinting that way. But it's covered up really, really nicely by these softer notes. I'm digging this, man. I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10 on the nose.
Yeah, I think as we get into the palate here, the flavor drops off a little bit because it just, there's a youth that underlies this that you can't get away from.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say it has some really nice vanilla notes that are strong for me. There's some rose petals, some toffee, and the young grain taste isn't bad, but it is present. I think I'll come down just a little bit from the nose, but I'll stick at a 6 out of 10.
I don't know how to say what I'm going to say in a moment without it sounding like super harsh on this whiskey. But when you're tasting whiskey for review purposes, you're not just sipping it and immediately swallowing it. You're like swishing it around your mouth. You're kind of kicking it from the back, front of your mouth to the back of your mouth. On the front of the palate, this is like syrupy sweet, and it's actually pretty viscous too. I thought it was going to be super thin, but it coats the mouth really nicely. But it's almost sickly sweet. And when I went to kick it to the back of my mouth, it just hit this one small part of my tongue that I got like a really weird note on. And it almost made me gag for a second. Not because it was like it tasted so bad, but because I think it tipped something off in my brain that it was going to go to bad places. And so I was like, huh! And then it didn't. Like it just, it became a very sort of smoky, almost ashy, sort of bitter taste on the back of my tongue. But what I'm left with is this sense that they're trying to cover up some of the harsher edges with a really sickly sweet flavor. Now, they obviously are not, they're not adding anything to this. They're not doing that. But you can tell that this is not a really high quality whiskey and B, a very well aged whiskey, because those harsh edges are still there. And it just kind of tastes like they dumped sugar on top of a pretty rough whiskey. It's not unpleasant, but I think my palate was trying to tip me off to something here, Brad. I'm going to give it a 6 out of 10 on the flavor. And I probably sounded harsher than I meant to be, but at the end of the day, like, this is a $18 bottle of whiskey for a reason.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%, man. I think that the finish is fine. It's light and floral. I give it a 6.5 on the finish. I think a balance wise, I'll give it a 7.5.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that there is anything wrong with this whiskey. I think that the negative notes are consistent throughout. The positive notes are consistent throughout. And so because of that, I'm not going to give it anything super high, but a 7.5 on the balance. And Bob, for $18, like, this is a really solid value.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give it a 7.5 out of 10 here.
All right. So just to recap, I'm going to go back to where you started. Finish, I'm going to give a 6.5 like you. Balance, I'll give a 7.5 like you. And what'd you give on value?
7.5.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is about as good as you can find for $18. It's also like not a great whiskey. I'm not mad at it because it's $18, but there's an almost like Splenda sweetness to this on the back part of the palate. And it's kind of hanging with me. I don't know if it would make a great mixer. I think it's a little bit too light to really stand up in a cocktail. You know, if you want to use this for Irish coffee or something, like, go for it. But it's a nice little sipper when you have already had the good stuff. It's like Jesus at the wedding at Cana. You know what I mean? Like, drink your good whiskey and then bust out the Clontarf. I'll give it a 7.5 as well, Brad. And that's taking me to a 34.5 out of 50.
Yeah, I am at a 34 out of 50, Bob.
Mm.
Like, I think this is a solid Irish whiskey at a bargain price. I would probably pay like $23, $24 for this. So at a sub 20 price, you really can't beat this, Bob.
No, you can't. And we're coming out to a 34.25 out of 50, or a 68.5 out of 100. That sounds a little low. Like, a 68 is like a failing grade. I actually think this is significantly better than that, but like, at the end of the day, it's pretty much a 6 whiskey across the board at a really good price point. I'm going to recommend this, Brad. Like, yeah. You know, if you want to try an Irish whiskey just to get a sense of what it could taste like, this is not a bad place to start.
Yeah, 100%, man. I think that Clontarf is doing good stuff here. I kind of want to go to Ireland and try some of the things they have over there, because I can imagine a world where a little better aged single malt would be really solid from this distillery.
This might have been the perfect thing to match up with this movie. Like, it is good, and it is clearly hinting at and mimicking other better products, but, like, I'm not mad at it, you know?
Yeah, 100%, dude.
All right, let's get back into talking about The Chronicles of Narnia. What do you say?
All right, everybody, that was Clontarf something, 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 a whiskey that we really liked for what it was.
Yeah, and it was something, something, something.
Yeah, what was it actually called?
Clontarf Classic Blend.
Ah, that good old classic blend.
I do still like calling it the Chronicles of Tarfia, so I'm going to continue doing that.
The Clontarficals of Narnia.
All right, Brad, after we took a week off last week, I am very eager to get into our next game, which we call Two Facts and a Falsehood.
Brad is going to try to stump you, Bob. Two are right and one is wrong. Two facts and a falsehood.
Two facts and a falsehood is the part of the show where Brad presents me with three items as fact about the making of this movie, one of which is a complete lie, and I have to figure out which one that is. Last week, Brad said that he felt guilty because he didn't want to shame Catholic Jesus. And so we took a week off. I'm going to claim it as a moral victory, if nothing else.
Mm.
My record...
Jesus dying on the cross for your sins is a moral victory for you, Bob?
yeah.
Is that on right? That was a trick question.
I was going to say, wait a minute. I think I understand how this works. All right. So I'm sitting at 11-6 on the season. Brad, let's see what you got. Hit me with your two facts and a falsehood.
Fact number one, the wardrobe featured in the film belonged to Lord George Cummington, Earl of Belfast, C.S. Lewis's hometown. Cummington's father shared a friendship with Lewis himself, prompting his son to offer the wardrobe for use in the film as a tribute. Fact number two, when the adults' swearing got out of hand on set, Georgie Henley, who played Lucy, set up a swear jar. James McAvoy was supposedly the worst offender. Even her teenage co-stars had to pay their toll. Fact number three, the movie was primarily shot in chronological order, with the exception of the final scene where the Pevensies fall out of the wardrobe. That scene was shot before all of the outdoor shots so that the kids would still be pale and look like they had at the film's beginning.
Okay, I'm just going to say this now. We have already made mention of the Freudian reading of this movie, and we have made fun of the word beaver. So I really hope that you didn't just make up a character named Lord Cummington. That's all I'm going to say. I'm going to take it. I'm just going to hope that one is true. I'm not going to pick it as the falsehood just because
okay. The
Freudian reading will be really weird if that's the falsehood. So number two or number three? I don't know, man. Number two sounds really plausible. And James McAvoy loves to drop an F-bomb in a lot of movies. Number three sounds really plausible, too, because not just because the kids are pale in those sequences, but a lot of times you only have locations secured for a few days, so you have to shoot everything you can there. Brad, I'm going to say that three is the falsehood because they just didn't shoot it in chronological order anyway. And I have no other reason for saying that other than I just don't want it to be Lord Cummington.
Bob, do you know why number two and number three sounded so plausible?
Because they're facts.
Because they're facts, baby.
You made up Lord Cummington.
I did not. I Googled make up a British name, and it came up with Lord George Cummington. It is spelled C-O-M-I-N-G.
Sure it is, Brad. Sure it is.
It sure is. So that was not a creation of my own. It was Google having a bit of a
weird Freudian
complex.
Yeah,
Freudian thing.
Anytime we watch a movie that you say is dirty from now on, I'm just going to say, oh, what did Lord Cummington show up? All right. I will take my L. Lord Cummington got me again, Brad.
He got you again.
Yeah.
What did he get you the first time?
Hey, man, don't ask. Don't ask.
Bro, this is a children's movie.
Let's get back into talking about Narnia. And Brad, we haven't talked about Tilda Swinton, who is the top billed person in this movie. Really interesting career Tilda Swinton has had. She's been a working actress since at least the 90s, maybe earlier than that. She's an indie darling. She's still working in independent film a lot. And like, she is known amongst the general population for being like the weird looking one. And I hate to say it like that, but like, she is a very interesting looking face. She is a phenomenal actress. And I had some weird struggles with her performance here. Not because she's bad, but I almost feel like she gave this character too many layers for the movie that was being made around her. She's developing a very complex character, because the White Witch is not just like, I'm going to shout at you and be demonically evil. She's cunning and she's really, really good at tricking, especially that scene with Edmund at the beginning. It's like chilling how you're watching her manipulate a child. She's not playing it with like a wink to the camera. She's not playing it as I'm, you know, the witch with an apple seducing Snow White. It's like psychological damage she's doing to this kid. And it's played so well. But it almost feels like the movie paints in really broad strokes. And it almost needed somebody who was more of a standard cartoonish villain. And so I feel weird saying that, like, the performance doesn't work, but it kind of doesn't work because she's doing more than the movie's doing around her.
Bob, you know what you just said? Tilda Swinton is too good for this movie.
Kind of. I mean, yeah. I think there's a version of this performance that she's just like, okay, like, I'm just going to do the, like, Jeremy Irons as Scar, like, just ham it up, sure. You know, and it's great. But she doesn't do that. She's trying something more subtle here. And it kind of just sticks out like a sore thumb, if I'm being honest.
Oh, man, I have watched enough movies and reviewed enough with you, Bob, to know that you are not the snooty cinephile. But Tilda turns in a hell of a performance here. I don't know what there is to complain. She gives this movie a depth that would not exist without her. I think the movie could work with a Jeremy Irons as Scar type performance. I'm not saying that part of the point is invalid. I guess what I'm saying is, of all the performances in this movie, Tilda Swinton is an A+. And she doesn't need to be. She could take her paycheck.
That's what I'm saying.
Turn like in a garbage performance, but she doesn't. This is Michael Caine with a bunch of freaking Muppets around him, and it makes the movie better. And I am all in on Tilda Swinton here.
That's a great analogy, dude. Because I agree with the analogy. I don't agree that it makes the movie better. But it's not her fault. So I'm not complaining about her. But it's like, she is adding layers and layers of depth to a character that would be right at home in Lord of the Rings and doesn't feel at home in this movie. And it's almost like, I don't know, I just felt like I was having the world of Narnia opened up to me every time I looked at her. I was like, what is this? I feel wonderment at this character. And then every other character is just like, oi, I'm a beaver. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's no other subtle things happening in the whole movie.
Oi, I'm a beaver. That's my whole personality.
Oh, man. Although Ray Winstone voicing that beaver.
Oh,
primo.
He's incredible.
It's so good.
It's so good, man. When you see him running around with armor on, you're like, yeah, why not? Mm-hmm. Of course he's a warrior. Mm-hmm. Dude, the little back and forth jibes or digs that Mr. and Mrs. Beaver take at each other incredible.
And they're all somehow related to her cooking, you know?
Yes. And she's like making fun of him for like drinking too much with his buddy.
Those are the moments that work in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like when we get away from the, here's a quest, there's a prophecy, go, go, go. Dude, when Beaver looks at the stone version of Badger, and like you've heard the jokes with his wife about his relationship with Badger, and then you hear him go, he was my best friend.
Oh, dude, it's crushing.
Oh,
it's so good.
Those are the moments where this movie succeeds.
Yep. It's kind of like an analogy that I would try to make is it's kind of like Dobby in the Harry Potter series, where Dobby is like they made a vast improvement on the Jar Jar Binks prototype. And they were like, this is Dobby. And he's going to kind of suck in the first film you see him in.
Jar Jar 2.0.
Yeah, because like you're like, oh, this is annoying as hell. And by the end of the movie, he says Dobby is free. And you're like, yeah, Dobby. Dobby's my boy. And then when you see Dobby die at the end of the seventh movie, you're like, that was one of the best characters ever made. I can't believe they just killed him. And I kind of feel like that with a lot of these side characters in Narnia. James McAvoy is inspired casting for Mr. Tumnus. He's so good. And he brings a much more, like a much softer side of himself to that performance. I think Ray Winstone as Beaver is incredible. And I wish that there was that much care and attention and color given to the human characters in this movie, because the Pevensey children, while they are like the audience surrogate, they're also the blandest characters, I would say, in the whole film.
Yeah, they kind of are, just a little bit. And I think that that's okay. The film doesn't necessarily need them to like shine crazily bright, but I don't know, man. We're back to the Tilda Swinton thing. Like, sure, everybody, it'd be better if everyone turned in an A-plus performance.
It would be better. This band of four merry hobbits that we have in these four children needed a Merry and Pippin. And they also needed a Frodo and Sam, and they didn't have any of those. Like, there's not fun characters represented in the four, and there's also not, like, the two characters you love, the way there are Frodo and Sam. And I think they want it to be either Lucy and what's the sister's name? Susan, or Lucy and Peter, but you don't really catch the bond between any of them that way. And so that like you already don't have as much of an emotional connection with these kids. And then, Brad, if I can make perhaps my most controversial statement in an episode where we've talked about Lord Cummington, I have never wanted to watch a child die on screen more than Edmund. That kid sucked so much. And I look like I understand how the gospel works. I know that mm-hmm. Aslan Jesus especially dies for Edmund, specifically because he is the worst among us. And it is a metaphor. I get that. I do not care. I like Aslan forgives. Bob Book does not. That kid
sucks.
Have
you seen The Voyage of the Dawn Treader?
I have not, no.
Oh, dude, you don't even know what you're in for.
Oh, does Edmund get drawn and quartered? Because I...
No. So, there is a... Their cousin, Eustace, goes into Narnia with Edmund and Lucy.
Mm-hmm.
And Eustace is like Edmund on steroids. He sucks so hard. He is so much worse than Edmund, and I'm with you 100%. Edmund is the worst in this movie. He has the most punchable face any 11-year-old I've ever seen.
He is like in this, I wish I could have thought about my Mount Rushmore of kids like this, but he has the kind of face that reminds me of Alfalfa from The Little Rascals, where it's like every time you see that kid come on screen, you're like, this fucking kid. Like you just hate him and you want to punch him. And he kind of looks like Alfalfa. And I don't know if you remember, but when the kid that played Alfalfa back in the 30s grew up, he was in It's a Wonderful Life for a hot second. And he's the kid that wanted to open the floor underneath George Bailey and mm-hmm. make them all. Yep. Yeah, that's Alfalfa. That's Edmund. I hate both of those kids. And I like for the whole movie, I was like, man, why does Aslan have to forgive this kid? He's the worst. People died because of Edmund. And they're just like, Aslan's just like, oh, what's done is done. Like, hold on. Like, what about friggin' Mr. Fox? He died because Edmund sucks.
Yeah, he sure did. And I liked Mr. Fox.
I did too.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I had to get that off my chest.
No, it's okay, man. Any other children you want to murder?
No, just that one for now. All of my rage has been directed to Edmund.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine with me, man.
Cool. All right, Brad. Well, I think with that off my chest, if there's nothing else about the film itself that you want to talk about, then it is time for us to get to our last segment of the day, which we call Let's Make It a Double.
We're near the end of the episode, so thanks for listening to the Film and Whiskey Show. Let's pair another film with this one, even if it's struggling. It's the final segment of the day, now let's make it a double.
Let's Make It a Double is the part of the show where we pick a movie to pair up with this one to make the perfect double feature. Brad, I'm anxious to hear yours, because I think the most obvious comparison point is Lord of the Rings, but I doubt that you went with that. So I'd like to hear what you thought of for your Let's Make It a Double.
You know, Bob, I was struggling with a movie to pick for this. I think a good pairing as far as like quality and enjoyability goes, because I think that Chronicles of Narnia is like a relatively high enjoyable film with like an above average quality of production. I'm going to pair it with Stardust from 2007.
I feel like there was 100 movies like this in the mid 2000s. There was another movie called Zathura that was kind of like I didn't
the Golden
see
Compass.
Yes, I didn't see any of them, and they're all the same movie in my like I've just jumbled all their posters together. So tell me about Stardust. What's that movie?
There is a young man who sees this beautiful girl, falls in love with her, follows her to like the edge of town. And it's almost like a magical version of it's like The Village or something. Is that the Shyamalan movie where there's like at the edge of the woods, there's others living out there? It's kind of like that.
OK,
where she disappears across this magical veil and he's trying to find her. And he goes on this adventure to cross the magical veil and save her from this evil witch. And it's just kind of a generic fun action adventure movie that, you know, it's nothing great. I think it has like a 7.5, 7.6 on IMDb. So like, it's just a really fun action adventure fantasy movie.
Nice. All right. So Brad's pairing it with Stardust. I'm going to pick a movie called A Monster Calls. It's a really good movie, and I haven't had a chance to recommend it before on this podcast, but essentially, it's a movie about a kid whose mom has a terminal illness, and he runs off every day into the woods and kind of imagines this giant monster that he talks to. And it's a movie it's all about processing through grief and processing through trauma. The monster in the movie is voiced by Liam Neeson. It's an incredibly emotional movie and like just a really good way. I think, you know, it'd be better for teenagers, but it's a really good way to teach kids about processing through trauma and grief. And it has Liam Neeson voicing the main monster of the movie. But beyond the Liam Neeson of it all, I think it's just a really good example of how we can use creatures that aren't real to act as a metaphor for things that are happening in our lives or things that are happening kind of cosmically, the way that Aslan does in this movie. So I really love this movie, and I've never recommended it before. It's called A Monster Calls.
All right. I'm in, man. That sounds really interesting.
All right, Brad, let's give this movie some final scores. I'll go first. I don't think that this movie, I'm sure that there's someone out there that hates this movie, but when I think about this movie, I can't really see anybody giving it less than like a 5. Like at the worst reading of this movie is like, it is mediocre. I also think that it's going to be hard to find anyone out there that thinks this movie is like a 10. And it just kind of feels like the natural bell curve of this movie is between a 5 and an 8. And so I look at the 6.9 on IMDb and I'm like, it does look a little low, but I can see how it would land somewhere in there. And you said like even a 7.2 would make more sense. That's kind of where I'm at with this movie. It is like almost there in every facet. And it kind of just depends on when you get out of this movie at the 2-hour and 20-minute mark. Do you ultimately feel like it was a good investment of your time or a waste of your time? And I think that's what's going to determine, are you a 6 or a 7 on this movie? I didn't think it was a waste of time. I like this movie quite a bit. I don't think I'll give it a 7.5, but I will give it a 7 out of 10.
Okay. I think that that's a fair score, Bob. I am a little bit higher. I really, really enjoy this movie, and it's been an IP that I've liked for most of my life. I'm at an 8 out of 10. Yeah. I think that the child performances are all, as we said, like B minus to B plus range. You have an incredible performance from Tilda Swinton and some of the voice actors from the animal characters. I'm in on this movie, man. It's a movie that I will come back to every 3 or 4 years, like gladly, and really enjoy it.
All right. So we are at a 7.5 out of 10 on average, but we'd like to know what you think. How long has it been since you've seen The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I should say. They did make two more movies. For me, it was 19 years. Does anybody have my record beat? Because I'm pretty sure I saw it like opening weekend. So come join me, brothers in arms. Let us know what you thought of this movie. You can find us on all of our social media accounts, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, or YouTube, at Film Whiskey.
Or you can jump onto the Discord. We are on there every single day talking to you guys, fans of the Film and Whiskey podcast. If you want to join the conversation, you can find a link to our Discord at the end of every single one of our show notes.
Next week, we are just tipping things into Funville for a week. We're looking at a movie that I can't believe grossed this much money, but it is 2006's Night at the Museum. Fun fact, a film that Bob Book has never seen.
What?
Yeah, I'm pretty pumped. I've never seen it before. So we'll be joined by a very special guest who'll be making his first time appearance on the show. So tune in next week for Night at the Museum. But until then, I'm Bob Book.
I'm Brad G.
And we'll see you next time.